Hi, this is Joe DeVito. You're listening to Awaken Nation with Brad Salas.
A huge shift is taking place on planet Earth. People seem to be waking up, tired of the way things used to be. They are creating something brand new and changing the world we live in. My name is Brad Salas, and I get to sit down with the next generation of idea makers, the disruptors, and the game changers. Everyday people, just like you and me, from all over, who are doing amazing things. Welcome to Awakened Nation.
Hey, everybody. I have someone I consider a friend on the show. We've performed together, but his career, I stepped away from that arena. He went off and now he's big time. I'm shocked he's on the show today.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Please welcome Joe DeVito to Awakened Nation.
Hey, how are you, Brad? I'm trying to think of the last gig we did together.
I think it was in Jersey.
It was either that or somewhere in Suffern. I think it was called Giggles.
You might be right.
Yeah. To continuing the tradition of comedy clubs with idiotic names. It's always the worst conversation with a comic where it's like, did you work Chuckles or Giggles with me? And I think,
yes.
Oh, we laugh snorts and guffaws.
What was there was a booker in Pennsylvania. He was like, his wife was Amish and he was Jewish. And, we were always in these weird venues. I remember driving for like 4 hours into the middle of nowhere with Rodney Laney.
Mm-hmm.
And as we pull in, it's a farm show arena. So people are parked on the grass. And I'm like, oh boy, this is not going to be fun at all. But yeah, we've had some crazy gigs, my friend.
Yeah, that's a part a lot of people don't realize. I didn't realize it either when I started, that you don't know that there's just working comics. I think most people think there, you got Seinfeld, Chris Rock, Amy Schumer, and then at the other end you have Guy from The Office doing open mic, and then you don't know that there's all these people at the levels in between slugging it out.
Well, I have always found Jeff Foxworthy's story funny, because not intentionally funny, but no pun intended. He was at the bar one night at one of the comedy clubs and he was crushing it. And I guess the club owner got a call and they said, do we have a comedian who's clean and can open for a country and Western act? And he happened to be there. So he started doing big venues, where we're talking 25, 30,000 people might be in the arena. And he did all that way before he did, his television show. So you never know when you're going to make it big. So,
yeah. Still waiting. Still fingers crossed on that.
Hey, dude, you are crushing it right now.
I'm working.
I gotta read your bio. I mean, people, if you don't recognize him or you do recognize him, this guy I admire for his dry wit, his humor, his pace, his cadence, and his work ethic. So we're going to get into that. Here's your bio, man. Comedian Joe DeVito's dead-on timing and unexpected twists make him a favorite at clubs in New York City and venues across the United States. Joe's a regular panelist on Fox's top-rated Gutfield show with Greg Gutfield, and he's also appeared on The Late Late Show, Last Comic Standing, Comics Unleashed, Comedy Central, AXS TV's Gotham Comedy Live. His special for Dry Bar Comedy has reached, and listen to this, 11 million views online. It's very impressive. Joe is also in demand as a comedy writing coach, helping new and established comics develop material and find their voice. And here we are officially welcoming Joe DeVito to the show.
Wow, that bio is true as the day I wrote it, huh?
It's awesome. Let's start out.
Sure.
And I this may sound like drivel at first, but what made you fall into comedy, my man? Were you funny in high school?
Yeah. I was the class clown, that type. I always tell people, if you grew up around the time we did, when I was a kid, I wasn't into sports or trucks, so I was in a lot of trouble. There's going to be a lot of trouble to find the way to survive the playground torture and all that. So I started being, funny as a way to win people over. And it was always something that I liked watching the funny guys in the comedies. Those were the guys I related to. And that was something that was very important in my family too. I had some uncles who were really funny, and my parents great sense of humor. I never thought it was something you could do until coworkers talked me into trying it. And,
Right.
you know, at the time, I think I was 32 years old, which at the time seemed old.
Yeah.
For a comic beginning, though, that is, you know, you really
Yeah.
should have something better to do with your time by the time you're in your early 30s. But I tried it, thought it was interesting, and I stuck with it and ended up changing my life.
It's funny. I see, you know, I look at my dad. You know, my dad is a joke guy. He has to tell a joke. You know, because I didn't grow up with the best childhood either, and I was the nerd who was in Drumline and loved Star Trek. And so if you're not into sports, you know, it was a different era. You got your ass kicked. But my dad is a joke teller. So he has to memorize these jokes, and he would tell a joke, and then he'd sit back and he'd be like laughing at his own wit. And I learned, you know, to keep him from losing his temper, to be like really fast, like ninja striking humor. It helps you from getting beat up. Did you find that to be true? You know, you could be fighting with the bullies.
Well, you know, and I think it also it's a valuable social skill for what comes with it. Everybody wants to be with the guy who's making them laugh.
Yeah.
And although it is interesting, I don't always buy into that at comics. We all, you know, I had a pretty easy upbringing, you know,
Yeah.
I'm loving family and all that. But I do think that you don't start it. You don't, if you think everything's fine the way it is, nothing motivates you to get on a stage and talk to strangers. You're just out
Right.
doing whatever it is people who are getting that from the rest of their life do. So I think that for me, it was, I always felt like no one was listening to me. That's what it was like. So I think that's what I got out of starting stand up was that, hey, I can get up there and I can speak and people will hear me for a change.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty cool thing.
What was that first gig like? You know, because
Oh,
you
yeah.
know, it's either an open mic or you know, you get challenged at someone's wedding or you know, it's one of those things. But what was that like? Your heart was probably
Oh.
jumping out of your chest.
I it was a coworker who talked me into it. We took a class, which was like five classes, and then they throw you on stage in front of friends and coworkers. I remember that whole day at work thinking, I can't possibly have to go to the bathroom another time. My biggest worry was dehydration from the nerves, but I made it through it. I remember thinking, wow, that was so interesting, you know. And the first time you're on stage and you get a laugh, oh, it's very intoxicating. And like a lot of people who try it, I did pretty well the first time and thought, no, maybe this isn't that hard. And then the next, you know, 15 times after that were bloodbaths.
You're a jerk, you know, and there's always a
Oh.
guy in the front row who wants to be a comedian who,
Yeah.
you know, gives you your better punchlines and you're like, yeah, that's great. When did you really say, okay, maybe I want to do this for a living? Because ladies and gentlemen, if you're listening and you're thinking about being in the entertainment industry or any of these things, it is not normal. And I'm not getting on your case about this, but my grandfather was a drummer in the big bands, and my mother sang and played piano. So I was in the entertainment industry. You know, as a kid growing up, I didn't relate to the Brady Bunch at all, but I did relate to the Partridge Family. So I, well, you know, I was used to going and playing drums. So this is not normal to practice and say, yeah, you know, I think I'm going to turn this into a livelihood. What was that like, that first writing? You know, you have to write your jokes and then you have to test them and all that. When did you make that transition to say, you know what, I'm going to do this for a living?
Well, the choice was kind of made for me because I come from a writing background, but I was writing
Nice.
advertising and some journalism stuff like that. So I was fascinated that I could write something, if you read it, you'd laugh. But then to put it on stage, it's a whole different story. So I think I was about 2 years into having tried it, and I was thinking, ooh, I think I might want to take a run at this. And I didn't even really know what that meant. And then my boss came in with tears in her eyes, said, we're having layoffs. They told me we got to let you go. And I said, well, do I have to pack up right now? And she said, no, you have 2 weeks. And I said, all right, well, this is all good. And then that gave me the kick in the ass to start thinking, all right, what does it mean to make a living as a comic? Because it's very hard. It's very hard
Yeah.
because there's no barrier to entry. So anyone can call themselves a comic.
Right.
And you know, and you start off and you're doing these $20 gigs, these $50 gigs. And it wasn't until I did in 2000, six when I did Last Comic Standing, and I made it to the semifinals, which was the top 30 something. After
Right.
that and that TV exposure, I was able to make a living doing that. So that was pretty cool because I wanted to be a rock star when I was young. I didn't know about telling jokes. I wanted to be on stage playing a guitar with women throwing their panties at me.
Yeah. You start to realize, you know, and I've noticed this with anybody who goes into entertainment, especially comedy.
Yeah.
You start to realize, okay, you make that transition from, okay, I'm the funny guy at work to the discipline of writing. And for me, it started with that little notepad I carried in my back pocket. And I'm a person who never remembered the funny bit I did to the cashier at Walgreens or whatever. And I'm like, what the hell was so funny about that? And I started to learn to write the joke down, you know, the premise, the joke, and all this. How hard was it to do that transition, number one? And number two, I mean, you're already a writer, but number two, sometimes the jokes you're telling, you know, in fun don't translate to the stage.
Yeah. To answer the first part, because I was a writer, I had a leg up on that, that I knew that there was a lot of repetition and refining involved, that it's all in the editing, to get the idea and then to pare it down to the fewest words possible. Because I was doing advertising writing, I was writing catalog copy for Book of the Month Club. I know, Book of the Month Club. And I always say that's like telling people I was a milkman, that writing direct mail for books for the Book of the Month Club. It's so, you know, ancient. So that part I understood. For me, it was the getting on stage and learning how to deliver the same joke over and over again, and to refine it and have it still sound conversational. And you know, when you first start out, just to get on stage is the biggest part of the hustle. You know, you have to do these amateur nights and the open mics where there's three people in the audience, especially the, I remember doing one in New York City in this basement of a bar called Siberia. It was near Port Authority. I don't know if you remember that one. And there was no sign, just a red light bulb outside the club. And a comic went up to do his open mic set. And right as he started to talk, the sewer pipe burst above him. And a big, like a waterfall, crashed in front of him. And he kept going without missing a beat because he paid his $5. And he was going to tell his jokes, come hell or high water, you know. So you have to have that insane drive. So that part, knowing that it was going to be a lot of repetition over and over again, that didn't bother me. What was the second part of the question?
I believe it was things don't work on stage.
Oh,
because you've written them.
Yeah. And that's another fun thing, too, is that, you know, there'd be the nerds like us with our notepads at these amateur shows. And there'd always be a cool guy with a beer in his hand saying, I'm just going to wing it. And he'd go up and it would always be a beating that.
Yeah.
Because it's not your friends, you know, to be funny on demand in front of strangers. It's so different. I don't even think they require the same kind of personality, because I know people who are hilarious. And some of the funniest people I've ever met were not comedians. But once you turn and face that, the audience, even if it's three people or 3,000, it's a whole different story.
It is. It really is. That's the difference between a pro and an amateur. Mm. When I was going around to the clubs and trying to make it, you know, Jim Gaffigan was really just starting out, and he had landed, I think it was car commercials. He was doing the Saturn car commercials, and Tom Shalhoub. I somehow managed to get Tom Shalhoub on one of my bringer shows down at the New York Comedy Club. I got 75 people into that little room. Tom Shalhoub was there. And then, who was the comedian who was the first cop to become like a comedian and get a TV show?
John DiResta.
Yes. John DiResta was
Who's
my
back.
Closer.
He's back at it.
He was funny as hell. Yeah. So I'm about to do the show, and I meet up with a buddy of mine I hadn't seen in a while. I invited him to the show. He was so nervous for me. He started writing jokes for me, you know, at the bar, you know, I was having a bite to eat. And he goes, here, this one might work, you know, and then he's throwing all this stuff at me as if I'm going to memorize it in the moment and get on stage. And
like you're not already shaking. And
yeah, I'm already freaking out.
Losing it.
What is the worst gig you ever did? Because I remember going on the road with Kareth Foster and Lisa Lampanelli. Oh. And the stage was a door. And they didn't even take the doorknob off. Okay. And everybody's sitting there eating. And then I went on the road doing dinner theater there for a while, or at least it felt like dinner theater. And every time, I mean, it's literally like this would happen every time. I go to hit my punchline and someone would drop a plate.
Yep.
So I could never. So what's the worst gig you ever did?
Oh, you know, there's so many, because this is part of the masochism of it, that the good feeling from a good gig, it evaporates so quickly, but the stink of a bad one, it'll stay on you. And when you first start, you know, you do these shows in restaurants where someone talked some owner into letting you, you know, amateurs go up and do a show. And those used to make me laugh, because you'd see the people who are just trying to have dinner and a show breaks out in front of them, you know, and the host would say, "Oh, what are you guys on a date?" And the couple says, "Yeah, hey, and you're ruining it. What are you doing?" So you would do comedy in places where people didn't, not only were they not expecting it, they didn't want it. They didn't. So I remember going to, it was a restaurant in Mayapack, New York, and I walked in and there was a guy with a guitar on this awful stage. And I said to the guy showing me around, I said, "That's not where we're doing the comedy show, is it?" And he went, "Oh, no, no." And he led me into a smaller, worse room. So we went, I was, after the show started, I said, can we go back in the other room? So yeah, I mean, there are ones, and it's not so much when you're bombing, it's more when you're irrelevant, when the people are ignoring you. Those are the ones that hurt. But you know, you learn how to deal with it, and you learn, you know, don't speed up, you know. But that's, I feel like, Brad, everyone can understand what killing feels like. If you've never done stand up, you can imagine the best you've ever felt in public. But bombing, I feel like everyone, because there are times when you're bombing that it's surreal. Did you ever perform at Dangerfields?
No, that's
that was
one
the best
place
place
I
to bomb. Bombing at Dangerfields was an out-of-body experience, because it was so dark you couldn't see the audience, and the sets were long. And you remember being up there and eating it for 20 minutes. Just, and no sound coming from, no visual. I thought, what's going on here? And those are the ones when you come off stage and you think, I think I agree with them. That was really bad. But you just have to keep pushing until the number of those and the number of good ones starts to flip until it's good ones almost all the time.
I had to do a gig in, there were two bad gigs. One was in Connecticut. There was this one room, I think it was in Danbury. And I had to open for Greg Gass, I believe.
Oh, Craig Gass, the impersonator.
Craig Gass, And so I had 10 minutes. And I got heckled from the bar on the other side of the wall. And then after I got off, I did my 10 minutes, but I got off quick. Yeah. And Greg was busy talking to the bouncer, and he was being who he is. And he's a great guy. And so I go to the bar, and I'm just pissed at these two guys, and they wanted to have a fist fight with me in the parking lot over my set. Mm. Yeah. Have you ever had one of those?
Yeah. I had a show where they were tormenting the opening act. And I remember saying to someone, "This is bad." And I told this, this woman who's friends with the opening act, she said, "I wish there's something I could do." And I said, "Yeah, there is actually. If it looks like I'm starting to flip, just tell me to breathe." So I go up and I'm doing my first, and there's this table of like 15 people up front, and they're loud. And one guy, he's coked up. So every time he gets up to go to the bathroom, he would stand up, walk onto the stage. And it's just so disrespectful. So finally I stopped and I hear the woman go, "Breathe, breathe." So I said to them, you know, put the mic down. And I said, "Look, you guys, you got to cool it, because you can't have a good time." You know, I handled as well as I thought I could. So they left, and everyone, you know, at the end of the night comes up to me like, "Oh, we're so embarrassed. These people make our town look bad." So as I'm getting ready to leave, the bouncer from the other part of the club comes over and goes, "Oh, the owner wants me to walk you to your car." And I said, "What's up?" And he goes, "Well, that table's been sitting in the bar the whole night and they're waiting for you." And I said, they're waiting to beat me up?" And he goes, "Yeah." And I said, "Well, why don't you tell them to leave?" And he goes, "Well, they're buying beer." So I realized that, like, oh, that's where I am. Like, they're still buying. It's okay if you get murdered on the way to your car. So yeah, I remember that was, you know, you're working a classy place when the place it's attached to has a mechanical bull. They're really going to enjoy my witticisms.
Nailed it. You crushed it, you know.
Yeah.
You know, they say whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger, and there's nothing
or
more
it just
like
severely
it.
Beats you, that it just maims you.
comedy really teaches you to try to deliver the exact same set every single time, no matter where you are, no matter if you're bombing or you're winning. You know, that magic time. My second worst gig was this drive all the way upstate New York. I think it was Albany. And there's a train station there with a restaurant in it. And the restaurant is huge. It's like one of those old timey, you know, and we had to perform in the other room. And I did my set, and there was a guy hitting on all the women, and he was slosh face drunk, and he's literally screaming in people's ears. You know, he's walking up to a woman, go, "Hey, you're beautiful." You know, he's screaming at the top of his lungs and causing disruption. And I did my whole set. I had, I think I had 40 minutes. And, you know, I was middling. The closer gets up. I go to the owner and I say, "Hey, dude, you got to stop this guy. Yeah. He's disrupting the whole show." Well, it turned out it was his best friend. And we were getting paid. Plus, we were getting really nice dinners. Well, I'm sitting there. And at the end of the night, I realized that was the wrong thing to do, to tell him that his drunk best friend was ruining the show. Because he had this attitude like, "Well, you guys should be more funny then."
Yeah.
And guess what? I got a plate of rice and, you know, old rice and I think pieces of chicken, which let us know he was not happy with us. And a horrible salad. I had ordered like a burrito with a bunch of other stuff. And I'm thinking, you know, I drove 6 hours for this, you know.
Yeah, it's nice when you have a nice long ride home to ponder your life choices.
Yes.
To really think, In a way that those awful gigs at the beginning are nice, and not just because they teach you techniques for dealing with that, but it weeds out people who aren't willing to suffer for this. If you want to do it as a career, I always tell people that the comedy pyramid has a very wide base, because most people come to their senses within the first 2 years. So if you stick with it past 2 years, either you've got something or you're too mentally ill to know that you should have stopped, which are both worth the same at that point.
Yeah. Well, it does. You know what I think it teaches you, Joe? When you are finally ready to do national television or international television, you have nerves of steel and you kind of have to earn it. My mother was a professional singer and we used to sit and watch American Idol, and I would just go, and the person I was with at the time, she was like, "Why are you so picky?" I said, "What did you hear my mom sing?" She finally heard my mom sing. And she went back and she had a whole different look at people on American Idol, because they didn't earn it. They, you know, you have to suffer through thousands of horrible gigs and maybe 20% are killer gigs where you sit there and you can brag that you crushed it. Do you find that true?
I think so. And it's an interesting comparison to music, because stand up, you have to fail in front of other people, which is very humiliating, because you could give somebody a guitar and lock them in a room or give them lessons or whatever. And when they made their debut, they might be great. Yeah. They might have technical mastery of the instrument. But the only way you get good at doing this is going up in front of an audience and seeing what happens once you say the words. That's why even, you know, the big shots still stop in at the small clubs to work out the new material, even if, you know, you get closer to knowing what's probably going to work. Yeah. But, and I don't think it should be any other way too. You know, sometimes you see comics who get the break too early and it messes them up because they don't have the chops. You know, I used to wonder why clubs used to make the audition process so unpleasant and uncomfortable. And then I realized, part of this is to see how you're going to handle that pressure. Because there are going to be times when you're on their stage on a primetime show and the whole audience isn't paying attention and you've got to get them. So you got to build up that thick skin and you got to get the chops.
I was always taught, and God bless Tim Davis, you know, he was doing comedy classes and all that. He taught me, find that one table or that one person that is into you. And just focus on them and the rest follow. And damn if he wasn't right. I've used that technique 100 times. But I want to ask you this, you know, you help up and coming comics right now and you help them write their joke and find their tone of voice. What's that like? Because that's enjoyable work, I would imagine.
I was surprised by how much I enjoyed it, especially when you work with brand new people because they don't have bad habits yet. and they say the funniest, most insane things. I'll give an example. I was talking to a comic. I think she was, you know, it's nice to hear them talk, you know, get to know them. You get to know about their lives. And she was talking about when the Aaron Hernandez special was on Netflix. And she, it was really funny because she was saying she didn't know who he was. And she thought he was very attractive. And then at the end, when it turns out he's dead, she was pissed off. So we started to talk about attractive serial killers. Who do you think is most attractive? And she said, well, everybody always says Ted Bundy. She goes, but if I had to choose the most attractive serial killer, gun to my head. And she didn't realize how funny that, like, what she said, if I had to pick the gun to my head. And I started howling. And I said, of all the expressions you could use, how beautiful that is. So, but I also enjoy that, you know, one of the things, it's so rare that people get asked, well, what do you think? And that's what stand-up is. You get to go up and you get to tell the world for 5 minutes, you're going to see the world the way I do. And right. It's just so interesting to see the way other people reflect their personalities, especially once they get it. You know, there's always the people, yeah. the comedy classes who want to tell jokes. They want to tell, you know, jokes they read off the internet. But when you see someone who's going up and they're expressing themselves, oh, it's so much fun because you know, sometimes I've had people in the class say, oh, I have a boring life. I don't know what to talk about. And then you ask them one question and they tell you, they have this one woman said, oh, I'm a mom. It's boring. And I said, well, what was your upbringing like? She's like, oh, I grew up in a cult in this walled compound. And she starts telling this insane story. So that part, I don't know, I guess because that's my version of when you see your kid hit a home run in Little League. When I see them then go up and get that rush, I'm like, oh, that was cool that I was able to help speed that along.
It's someone said this once, and I always say yes to this, and that is, comedy is not therapy, but it's therapeutic. Do you find that to be true?
Oh yeah, and also I've seen when it's therapy that there are times where you're watching someone on stage and you think, I don't, unless you're giving us a copay, you should have gone to a pro to share this. Because that's, you'll hear comics say that when they'll have a couple bits bomb in a row and they'll say, hey, I'm just here for the therapy. It's like, oh, okay. It's like when a comic tells a joke that stiffs and they say, I guess that one's just for me. And I think, well, then don't tell it to us. Tell it to yourself when you get home. But it can be therapeutic because you talk about what's on your mind, ideally. And if that's what's on your mind, work through it.
How do we get a hold of you? Where's your schedule at?
Oh, joedevito.com, and I'm at Joe DeVito Comedy on the social media.
Excellent. You're worth watching, my friend. I have to be honest with you. I watched all your sets because I just found your cadence. I'm not that type of comic. I can be a little wacky. I do the voices. I imitate my dad. You have this dry, almost deadpan, boom, here's the delivery, but it's so damn funny. Oh, and we love standing in the back of the room watching you perform. Because, you know, one of the things in comedy, folks, if you're thinking about becoming a comedian, is you got to be fearless. Okay. You got to be no cowards on this stage. You know, if you're going to get up, got to do it. And I've watched you win over some rough audiences. You know, it's fun. I always knew when I walked in the room and Joe DeVito was there, I was like, hey, what's up? I knew we were going to have a great show because yeah, I mean, it's some comedians walk in, they don't intermingle with any of the other comedians. Yeah. They just sit in the corner and they write and they do their thing. And nothing wrong with that. I'm not knocking that. But when you've driven 4.5 hours, you know, and you know, it's the Farm Show Arena and almost everybody in the room has a camouflage baseball cap, you know, I did a gig in Pennsylvania, which is where I'm from. And I walk in dressed like a yuppie and I'm like, oh, I got to rough this up a bit. So I pulled out my shirt and I rolled up my sleeves.
Rubbing mud on your face
rugged, you know, and everybody in the audience had camouflage caps on, you know, hunter's caps. And I know how to connect with them. And I was like, you do realize we can all see you, you know, hacky joke, you know, but it, you know, it's just, it's wonderful to see you thrive now, because I, you know, folks, if you're listening or you're watching this, I got to tell you, imagine going to college for 4 years, then you want to specialize and you go to more college for 2 more years, maybe 4 more years. And then when you get out, you are not guaranteed a job or even a job interview. That's comedy. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. To when it comes to stand up, if you're getting paid, you're doing something right, because that's that comedy pyramid. That's you're very near to the top if you're getting paid to do it. Yeah, it's pretty wild, because like I said, I had no idea that I could turn any of this into a career. And I think that helped. I think that helped that when I started, there was no social media. There was none of that stuff. And comedy was not, you know, I started it in 2001, which was not a cool time for stand-up comedy. So when we would go do these shows and these, you know, amateur nights and little shows and bars, none of us were really thinking we would turn it into anything, because there wasn't anything to turn it into. You just did it because you wanted to make people laugh and have a joke get over, or the little crew of guys you ran with, someone would tell a joke and you'd say, ah, that's better. Or we fooled them this time.
Right. I remember going to my first comedy club when I was in college. I went to college for art and design, so I really couldn't call it college, but we were having fun. My buddies and I, we jumped into the van, and this is the early 80s. And Larry Bud Melman was headlining, you remember, from the Letterman show?
Sure, sure.
And so we drove all the way out to the south side through the tunnel over there. And we get there, and I was just so blown away by the performance. And Larry Bud was hilarious. He was doing toast on a stick, remember? But I found out through the years, you know, for those of you who think that comedians are making millions, I'm going to let you know, if you were in comedy in the 70s and 80s, if you were middling, which is the person after the MC or some opening act that was a newbie, the middle comedian got $750 for a show. And then the headliner got $1,500. So they got a piece of the door. And, you know, if they were a big headliner, of course, they made a lot more money. So here we are now today. Sometimes you make $15 in a chicken dinner. And, you know, or you get $350 and you've done 2 45-minute sets back to back, and you're just fried. Okay. If you get paid that. Do you find that's true today? It's like, it's a little harder to make a real living if you're up and coming.
I've heard about when comedy had the 80s boom, that you could make a living as an MC, because there was no, you know, they didn't have cable. So I guess people, if you wanted to see stand up, you had to go to a club. And from what I've been told, the clubs were full, you know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and that you could get that cash. But I had a feeling about that early on. I remember the second time I did one of the amateur shows and they had a pro come in. This was in New York City. And he went up and he had TV credits, and especially after, you know, 90 minutes of amateur comics where we're all sweating and having heart attacks. And he went up and he crushed. And I thought, I've never heard of this guy. He's so good. Wow, someday. And on the way out, I saw them hand him a $20 bill. And I thought, oh, okay, maybe this is you don't do this for the money.
No.
Yeah, it's pretty, I mean, obviously, once you get to a certain point, if you want to support yourself, you have to push through to get to that next level. But I don't think any of that was on my mind when I started. It was just figure out how to get these people in this bar in Queens to laugh, and then how to do it in a way that next time I do it, it'll work again and again and again.
Yeah. Well, one thing I've noticed, which has helped me as a corporate speaker, I do keynote speaking now. The crowd work, you know, that's where the comedian comes into the crowd or starts talking to the crowd and goes off of his, you know, script or any bits that he's written and makes jokes with the audience. And a lot of times that works when the audience isn't buying your jokes at first.
Yeah.
So you go and do crowd work and you come back. That has helped me immensely in corporate, you know, gigs, because they don't care if I'm coming, you know, I'm doing crowd work and then I do. But I've noticed the very best comedians, they don't do crowd work. When Jim Gaffigan is working, he doesn't do crowd work. He's doing, looking down, doing his set, and he's practicing. Do you do that as well, or do you do a little crowd work?
I do. It depends on the mood I'm in. I know a lot of those guys, like Gaffigan, doesn't really talk to the audience. Bill Burr is not into that. But they're also, those are guys who are working out new specials, so they don't really need to chit chat. That was always the funny thing, that you'd finish a set and there'd be some idiot in the audience who kept interrupting and interjecting. And then afterward, they'll come up with a big smile on their face and they'll say, "Hey, I was helping you out." It's like, yeah, thank you. Because when I drove here tonight, all I could think was, I hope there's an idiot in the audience who keeps yelling stuff out between my setup and my punchline. Because I want, I'm not showing up with prepared material. But I'm well, when I do my sets, unless I'm getting ready for something where I have to stick to a script, I organize it by blocks, that this is this block of material, then if it feels right, I'll move to different blocks. So there's that keeps me engaged. I don't want to go up and just do it by rote. But what's in between those things is sometimes I'll just be in the mood to chit chat. I'm not a big fan of the endless. "So where are you guys from? Where are you guys dating?" If it's not leading to anything, these guys, they go up sometimes and you think, are you working for the Census Bureau? Like, let's, how about some jokes? So, but I have to say this, there are times where when crowd work gets over, it's because you just experience a moment for everybody that was just for everybody at that show. So it was like a little puff of magic smoke in the air. So yeah, sometimes it's good, but me, I'd rather just say my jokes.
Well, sometimes you cannot ignore something that's in the audience.
Yeah.
And I was opening for Tom Rhodes down at the Comedy Factory, I think it's called, down in Baltimore,
Yeah.
Maryland. And I get up on stage and I realized, and my ex-wife is black, so I have a lot of jokes about that. They sat every single black person around the front of the stage, and every white person was the rest. So 3/4 of the room is all these white people all out in the back, and African American people in the front, husbands, wives, they even brought their young son. So I decided to make it fun for them, and I said, "Hey, if the roles were reversed in this room, it would probably be a little scarier. Am I right?" And they just howled laughing. And so sometimes you do have to comment on the situation.
And I think people they just want you to be funny, and there's a million ways to do it. And if it's because you call something in the room, it's nice because it shows that you're present. That's a good example you gave. I always tell people, you never do a show for a black audience and leave thinking, "I wonder how I did," because they let you
They
know.
will.
They let you know pretty quick. And one night I was at Governor's here on Long Island, which is one of my home clubs. And for some reason, one of the fundraisers, the audience was, I think, almost half African American, which is kind of unusual, for the demographics. So I started to do material that I do when I'm working, an urban room. And the audience loved it because it was just, it's funny when they hear it coming from a white guy. And
Absolutely.
when I got home and I looked at, I had set up my camera, and the camera was shaking because black audiences get into it, and they're like banging on the table and stuff, and the camera's jumping up and down. So that I saw that, and I thought, oh, that's pretty cool, because it's nice. You want to be able to go into something outside your comfort zone. It's still, oh, you want to get that job done.
I did one gig at the Chitlin' Circuit, and they didn't like me right away. It was just that was it. And I understood that, and I bombed big time. But I think if you have respect for another culture and you go down that road and you just kind of you make it wittier than what everybody else is doing. The difference between this person,
They don't want pandering.
no pandering. Don't do it like that. I used to talk about getting engaged, to my ex-wife, when we first got engaged, and then the audience wouldn't respond at all. I go, "Oh, great, that was my family's response."
So you learn from it.
They roll, they would howl, and I just find if you are a comedian, I don't know about you, but crowd work for me was never mean. I'm not mean. I don't have that in me. Some comedians, they just, you're not a mean person. I know that about you, so I'm
But
sure that
if they like you, you can get away with saying some pretty outrageous stuff.
that is true. That is true.
Yeah, I did a show. It was all the whole audience was Korean, with some special event, and I was the only white comic. And I went out and I said, I feel a little weird being the only white performer. I'm afraid I'm going to say something inappropriate, and people might get mad at me. And I said, and they kind of chuckled. And I said, "Oh no, I guess I just get nervous around this many Chinese people," which they I got a big response. And I said, "I prepared for tonight's show by watching a marathon of MASH," and then they booed at that. And I was like, "All right, I took it too far. I should have quit while I was ahead.
You were willing to go there.
But sometimes you get points just for being willing to be a jerk. Like, just to say a stupid thing. They're like, okay, you tried.
The weirdest gig I ever had was a kosher Mexican restaurant. Yes, kosher Mexican Mexican restaurant in New Jersey had opened. I think it closed a month later, but they couldn't have cheese with meat. You know, that was the big deal. So they had tofu cheese, I believe. And so, yeah, I get out on stage and it's a mix of observant and also Hasidim. And so I had a yarmulke on, and I had so much fun at that gig.
Yep.
And here was the funny part. I was so respectful and I speak a little Yiddish and I had a little Hebrew in there. They came up to me and they asked me what temple I go to. They thought I was Jewish. And that to me is an example of respecting the culture, respecting the joke and the people. Because one kid was there, he had just bar mitzvah. He was like 13. And I looked at his father and said, he's a man now. Are you going to let him have the Mercedes tonight? You know, and the father's like, hell no. You know, you learn the culture before you're going to go on stage. Have you had any other gigs where it was like, it was definitely an ethnic group?
Yeah.
And you had to do a little research before you went up there.
Well, you know, I do. You gave a good example because there's huge circuit of temple and synagogue shows. And I've done dozens of those, even though I'm not Jewish. I was raised Catholic. And I've learned the kind of jokes that work for that. To, you know, one of the things I'll do is I'll go up and I'll say, am I the only Gentile here? And they'll, you know, laugh and I'll say, I thought I might just be here as a Shabbos goy. And if you don't know what that means, ask a Jewish friend. But I think when I make that joke, they're like, oh, he kind of did a little research. And then I have a couple of other jokes that I know work for that audience. And then I just, you know, you just go into talking about my own life. And that's what people relate to. But yeah, I think they appreciate that. Oh, this person cared enough to kind of find out who we are.
Yeah, people don't realize there's comedy circuits for every ethnic group out there. Mm-hmm. I did Mayor Bloomberg's cousin's temple out in Jersey. And when the guy I picked up who booked the event looked at me, he says, could you be any more German looking? And I laughed. I said, don't worry, I have a yarmulke. I can look fine. I'm not German, I'm Irish. Mm-hmm. And Hungarian. And so he was on from the moment we got there. But you do learn, like with a Jewish audience, you do not swear, you tell family jokes and stories, you don't get dirty or any of that. So you learn, you know, you learn how to make it work. And they're very respectful audience. I love them. You know, with other ethnic groups, you learn certain things and a little bit of the language too. I find that the fun part. Learning a little bit of the language is very helpful.
Yeah, sure. Well, coming from you, that would sound hilarious. It's because it plays against type. Exactly. I've been told by the Jewish comics on those shows that the Gentile comics, they're much more forgiving. The Jewish comedians, the Jewish audiences, they scrutinize them a little bit more. But it's to me, that's just, I don't know. I think the whole thing is just so amusing. As someone who grew up Catholic, I can't imagine Catholic comedy night. It's like very, sure, I'll go to the temple. Yeah, that sounds like a much more entertaining evening.
So Jesus walks into a bar. Yeah, I grew up Catholic as well, so we're forgiven for this. That Jewish kosher restaurant, my opening line was, I walked in and the place is, you know, it has all these banners and everything all over the place and everybody's sitting around, you know, they're trying to make it Mexican without, you know, being Mexican and no alcohol. And so all I said was, I said, why do I feel like I'm on a cruise ship to Israel and tonight's the wacky Mexican night?
Sure. Well, from Mexican to Jews. So that's going from the largest possible hat size to the smallest possible hat size.
Exactly.
There is funny that sometimes you'll show up at a gig and you look around and you think, what made someone think this was a good idea?
Yeah.
But you never know. You can never judge. I mean, I've gone into scenarios where I thought this would be a piece of cake and it was work. And there are times where went in and everyone else was eating it, and it turned out to be a good time. So you learn to keep that part of your mind open too.
My favorite frustration is when every comedian is recording their set so they could mail it in, and that's the night we have hecklers. It's the worst. Have you found that everybody's talking about this, but this political correctness in the college campuses and the sort of, you know, cancel culture and all these things that are happening, did that affect you at all? And is it turning around at this point?
Well, you know, I think because I started doing stand-up in my 30s, that by the time I was working, I was 40. So I never really did a lot of colleges.
Yeah.
So that wasn't a big issue for me. The problem I had with colleges, the few that I did, was I was too much older than them. I couldn't really relate.
Right.
Yeah, as far as getting canceled and all that stuff, I think that's a legitimate concern. But I think what we're seeing now is people just want to laugh. And comedy, to me, is supposed to be transgressive. And the good news is it's easier than ever now to find an audience who wants to see what you do. So if a certain club says, we're not going to book you because of this or that, you can find, with a little hustle, you can find your own audience. You can find your own place. You can do your, you can book a place of your own. You can find a club that aligns with you. Now, I'm not someone, I mean, you know, people see me on Fox News, and that's a good demographic for me. I don't really do politics in my act, probably because I'm marinating in it, writing those jokes all day long. But I'm not up there. I don't like the idea that a comedian is going to go up and give you some political lecture. If you know what comedians are like, you'd think, why would I listen to this person? So,
right.
You know, there's a person who's going to give you a political lecture, and then, you know, they have five roommates and they're 48 years old. You think maybe this is not the guy to talk to. So I think it's a problem in our culture, but I don't think in stand-up it's that big a deal. And I've started to notice that in New York City clubs, they're starting to like it if you push your luck a little bit, because comedy's supposed to be transgressive. That's what makes you laugh. You don't laugh at people behaving themselves.
Well, comedy is kind of attacking or massaging the undertones of the zeitgeist in our culture that we believe. You know, God bless him, I saw George Carlin 6 months before he died, and he was working from notes on the stage, testing and seeing if this will work or that'll work. And that is really what it is, going against the common, you know, thing that we all agree on. And suddenly the comedian comes along and thinks differently.
Yeah.
And I think that you have that skill. I mean, you see things. I've watched you on Gutfeld. It's hilarious. Some of your answers, I was like, I never thought of it that way.
Ah, see, to me, that's a sign of a good joke, is if someone hears it and thinks, I never thought about it that way, but I know what you're talking about. So if you're able to get those two contradictory things in a joke, you did all right.
That's hilarious. Folks, I'm going to play a small clip of Joe on stage. Here we go. Roll the tape.
Get right into the personal stuff. I'm a single guy. I'm single and I just turned 50, which means I'm ready to cut a deal. So, maybe you have a nut job sister-in-law you're trying to shove off on someone. I'll take a look. You know, whenever I say that, men laugh and women go, what about Carol? Every woman has a specific nut job friend. They immediately think of, they're a single guy. Carol's due for release in a few weeks. What's the range on her ankle monitor? Please, I don't need help meeting crazy women. I've got that locked down. Trust me, I'm good. That's my core demographic. But it is, it's a strange age to be single. At age 50, I didn't think that was going to happen to me. And it's because dating is not designed for people my age. You don't hear a lot about single guys my age. And that's because we're gross, we're creepy. I don't want to hear about it either. I'd rather be up here talking to you about single women aged 25 to 30, but I can't do that. Because they blocked me on Instagram. They shut me down. They said, it's weird, though. I like when people say to me, oh, dating over 40. What's that market like? Yeah, market. Well, it ain't Whole Foods. It's not the freshest selection. I'll tell you what it's like shopping for a partner when you're 50 years old. Have you been to TJ Maxx? That's what it's like. Yeah, there's a selection, but it's a lot of last year's styles. A lot of odd sizes. And even if you bring something home, you won't know exactly what's wrong until you've had it on you a couple of times. You'll start looking for that receipt. This is irregular. This is very irregular. I even had long hair. Oh, my long hair. When I was in my 20s, I grew my hair down the middle of my back. Now it grows from the middle of my back. It's awful. I go to the beach, it's like My Little Pony's running around. It's terrifying. But I don't say any of this to my barber because my barber's Russian. You don't mess with Russian people.
No.
Toughest people on earth. No sense of humor. You ever have a Russian person tell you a joke? It's just a scary story. Then they laugh at the end. Give you a punchline like, and in winter, grandma died. And they always act like it's a translation issue. No, it's much funnier in Russian. The whole village was killed.
I find you hilarious, and let's just dig into it and unpack this. What is dating like at 50?
I'll tell you something interesting about that joke. I've been playing around with that joke for a while. And if I go through my videos, I have jokes of me saying that same joke at age 40 and 41 and 42 and 40. And then the first time I said it at age 50, it hit me on stage that, oh, this is a different joke. It's a different joke about saying you're single at 50 than at 49. Because right up until 49, people... the attitude is you'll find someone. And then once you're 50, it's, hey, this is it. So, I think that's one of the things that helped me differentiate myself, because a lot of comics talk about dating, but they tend to be younger, you know? And when I did that, the dry bar comedy, which is clean comedy for, you know, older audiences, that set me apart, because I can talk about getting older and I can talk about dating and I can talk about where those two things intersect.
I love that set, and you just said it, you know, you resonated with the audience big time. So I love that. It's a very funny bit. What's her range on her ankle monitor? That I spit out my drink. Yeah, little details. I spit out my drink when I was listening.
See, now dry bar originally, that special I did for them had a name. But then when they posted it on YouTube, they just called it middle-aged dating. And I was like, come on, guys. that's a bit of a bummer of a name. But then I saw how, you know, if you go through YouTube comments, which I don't always recommend, but it's interesting to see, like, oh, yeah, people, you know, I shared an experience and people relate to it. That's pretty cool.
Well, let's talk about that, you know, because there are a lot of comedians now that made their fame on YouTube, and then the comedy came along. Like, I think it was like JP Sears, the Hodge brothers, the Hodge twins. These are people who now had such a big following. They can now go on tour on their own. They don't need to have a booking agent. They just do it.
Yeah. It's pretty cool. It's similar to what happened with music. Music did this a little bit ahead, where there used to be all these gatekeepers. And there used to be this process you had to go through. And now when you can put it up, the downside is anybody can put something up. So that there's just a ton of content out there. But people who can do it themselves can find their own audience, and they don't have to go through someone. Because it's like anything else. You learn that a lot of the people who open and close the doors, I don't know what the hell they're talking about. They're no more of an expert than anybody else. They're just
right.
They're a bureaucracy that gets in the way. So Yeah, you'll even see some comics like Andrew Schultz and Tim Dillon and Sam Morril. Like, these guys harness that power of the internet, and they built their brand and they found their fan base. And those were guys that the clubs weren't really pushing them. I mean, they I think Andrew Schultz had to buy back one of his specials because they wanted to mess with it. He said, "No, it's mine." And he bought it back and he put it out there, and it's been a huge hit. And I respect the hell out of those guys. They're younger than me, so they were able to figure that out, and they did it their way, and they didn't compromise. That's another thing that's, to do the artistic part of it, artistic. I mean, I realize we're talking about jokes here, but to do it their way, and that's so important that people hear your jokes the way you meant them, because you don't want people going in and messing with that. It ruins the whole point of doing this.
I agree with you. I really do. It is a different game nowadays. And I remember some people were saying when millennials arrived, all of a sudden there were PowerPoint and videos on stage that had never been seen before. And they are funny. What is it? Dimitri Martin was one of that I said,
He
this.
did it with the drawings and the easel. He was analog.
I was like, this is hilarious. This guy's either a genius or his dad said, hey, I'm not paying for a projector. You're going to do it on your own. And it also seems like people's star burns out really fast, much faster than it did in the past. Because now if I mentioned Dimitri Martin, there aren't many people who know who I'm talking about. So do you want to talk about that a little bit? It seems like it's, and then.
Well, I think this goes back to what we were talking about earlier about some of that dues paying, that it's not just the suffering, it's just it takes a long time to learn how to do this, and even longer to get good at it. It's like when you used to see those commercials for a karate school, and they would have all the 8-year-old black belts, and you'd think, really? The 8-year-old black, are you gonna kick my ass? I don't think so. So it just requires a certain amount of time. So and I hear that from the comedy clubs too, that they'll book someone who's more the social media influencer type of comic. And they'll say, yeah, that person can fill up the room on this night with just their fans, but you can't put them up in front of an audience who doesn't know who they are, because they never built those skills, or at least they haven't built those skills yet. So I think if you want to be a stand-up comic, you have to learn those lessons. You have to learn how to turn around an audience of people who don't like you and don't know who you are, and you have to be able to do that. So I think they may be missing out on that, but I can't fault them. I mean, there's some people I look at their stuff and I think maybe I'm too old, I don't get it, but they got a zillion followers, and they'll fill up a club. So good for them. I don't feel threatened or competitive with that, because I look at it and I think, well, that isn't even what I do, so why am I going to sweat it?
You really have to focus on your own comedy voice. I wanted to ask you this. Well, Dane Cook, really, his claim to fame is he actually started sending out emails. He collected a vast email list and had it localized. Whenever he was flying into this town, he would email everybody and he would pack the rooms, and all the bookers were like, who the hell is this guy? And so you really do see it. I wanted to talk, what was it like when you got that phone call to be on Gutfeld? What was that like?
Well, I had met Greg when he was doing Red Eye, which was his first show that was on Fox News at 3 o'clock in the morning. And it was, a weird, kind of no rules, woozy, had sort of this delirious vibe to it. And the manager I had at the time, they put out a call like, we think we want to have comedians. And we weren't even on the panel. We were actually in the newsroom, so it made it look like we were remote. We were just downstairs in the basement. So I started to do that, and of course all gratitude to that, because that's how I learned how to do TV. There's no class you take to learn how to do that, and this was before podcasting, going back at least 12, years ago. So it was good because it eased me into learning how to do that. And I remember the first time they moved me onto the panel, sitting there like, what does a human do with his hands? He's like, you're so subconscious, like, ah. But yeah, the show has been fantastic, and it's pretty cool when people know you from a panel. I was talking to an agent, and he said the difference is when they know you from a sitcom, they know you as the character. So there's some remove. But people who know me from the show know me as me, as know me as Joe DeVito. So
Right.
they feel that connection. It's cool. It's still a little weird sometimes when I see someone do a double take and come up, and I don't know. It's like I hope the experience for them is everything they were. There I am in my sweats in the supermarket buying some, cans of tuna. Like, oh, I hope this the illusion of showbiz hasn't been ruined. But yeah, it's been great for my career.
I met Jack Nicholson's son.
Yeah,
Everybody gets mistaken for somebody else. Ladies and gentlemen, reach out, joedevito.com. Go see him in person live. He's hilarious. And watch him on Greg Gutfeld's show. Just phenomenal talent, man.
Oh,
Worked
thank
his he took us off to
you.
get where he is today. And thank you for being on Awakened Nation, my friend.
Ryan, man, thanks. It's always good to talk to you.
You got it. So I have a lightning round. I'm going to ask you three questions. Yes, three fun questions. Don't be nervous. My first question is, what is your favorite memory?
My favorite memory. I'm, I think, 13 or 14 years old. And because I went to public school, I had to go to catechism classes to get confirmed. I had to go to CCD classes as a Catholic.
Right.
And my father was driving me to the Catholic school at night. And I was so miserable, I didn't even complain. I was just sitting there quietly. And right when we got to the town we lived in, he turned to me and he said, how about we go see a movie instead? And he took me to see Airplane, of all movies, like the funniest movie. And he said, don't tell your mother. So I remember that being such a tremendous reversal of what I thought the evening was going to be. So yeah, that's a pretty good memory.
You're going to hell. That's funny. My dad did stuff like that, and I think it helps us be better men. We're more relaxed. We're not so uptight.
Sure.
Yeah. My second question is, what pisses you off?
Oh, I invite anybody to watch my hours and hours of stand-up to get insight to that. But I would say my one of my least favorite traits is people who monopolize a conversation and they don't realize that the other person hasn't spoken. That people who just talk too much.
Yeah.
And I did enjoy this. I was on the Long Island Railroad the other day, and someone came on. Cell phone speaker, full volume, blaring the stupid conversation. And then someone else came on doing the same thing. And when they sat down next to each other, they both gave each other dirty looks. And I thought that was very rewarding to think, like, oh, you two jerks are actually ruining each other's jerk day. So I thought, okay.
I can see that because it's like, how dare you? Well, you're doing the same thing. My third and final question is, do you have any hopes or dreams, whether it be Hollywood or a sitcom or whatever, where you would like to work with someone you really admire?
Oh, wow. You know what? I think I'm going to flip that. I'm going to flip that and say what I'm looking forward to and what I'm adjusting my schedule is to go back to working with more new comics because I really enjoyed that. And I miss teaching the classes and working with the people one on one. And, with writing for Gutfeld and doing stand up, I kind of ran out of time for that. And I'm going to make more time for that. So I would say instead of the famous established people I want to work with, I want to work with the people on their way up and see if I can share some of what I learned with them. I think I'm looking forward to that.
God bless you, man. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Joe DeVito here on Awakened Nation. Thanks, brother, for doing the show. I appreciate it.
Right on, my pleasure.
You bet. Hey, everybody, tune in next week. We have another fantastic guest once again here on Awakened Nation. Until then, bye-bye.
Thank you so much for being a big part of the Awakened Nation movement. This is how you can help me and our extraordinary guests. If you guys enjoyed this episode, please share it out on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And let's grow this movement by word of mouth. Our success will be because of you. Thank you, and see you next week.